Secretary Muskie brought with him to the State Department as his personal assistant, Leon Billings. And Leon is, I know very well. He's quite an extraordinary personality. He hadn't been there very long when he, I think, became quite unhappy with the bureaucracy of the State Department. I believe that things could be accomplished that in an administrative way that proved almost impossible to effect.
What is he doing now?
He first went into a consultancy business, but I saw the reference to him the other day as either the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee chief aide or one of the he's involved in the Congressional Senate in some fashion.
Back on it.
I know that Ed Muskie was quite worried because when I last talked to him after the change, he when I came back the last time, that Leon was not a lawyer. He was a political scientist, and he was worried about what provision could be made for his future. But with the skills he has, I'm sure it'll work out okay. And we had a session also at this point, sat in with Dick Holber when he met with Ambassador Chai about it. Again, a threat from North Korea. We always, of course, got the same answer. We do not interfere with our friends. That's why we have so many friends. Then I note that I had luncheon at Bardil Tirana's house. I had gotten to know him in connection with the inaugural festivities in January of 1977. He had invited me to the house to his house, the two of us, to meet Joshua Minor, who was the admissions director at Phillips Academy in Andover, which is certainly one of the leading prep schools in this country. And the purpose of it was for Mr. Minor to explain to me that he had gone through the back door to recruit three young Chinese to come to Phillips for the fall term, for their final year. This had been done through a Chinese-American who had contacts in Harbin and through the Harbin Institute of Technology. And it was all set. Joshua Minor had been to Harbin, had interviewed the families, had interviewed the students, and he was just apologetic that it had not been done through the embassy and had not been done through me personally. I assured him there was no problem at all. And I sort of forgot about it until I got back to China some 2 months later. At the end of July, I get a telephone call from Mr. Minor. Unfortunately, the three students he had recruited can't get exit permits. And so I said, well, there's nothing I can do about that. He said, I don't want you to do anything about that, because I have been told that they have been chosen to go to Chinese institutions. That's why it's not possible for them to get exit permits. He said, can you get me any three Chinese students? I said, when do you want them? This was early August. Well, he said, we still want them to come for the beginning of the fall term, which would have been about a month from then. I said, I can give you no hope because things don't move very fast in China. But we took it up with the Ministry of Education, the Harvard Institute of Technology, and lo and behold, very quickly they came up with two young men and a young woman, also from Harbin. And they duly got their exit permits. I was back here in Ann Arbor when sometime in the summer of 81, I got a letter from Mr. Miner. He thought I would like to know what had happened to the three Chinese students. They'd all done very well. One had gone on scholarship to Harvard, one to Stanford,
my God,
and the woman to Pennsylvania. And that he had three Chinese replacements who were scheduled to come in for the next fall term. Then he came to Ann Arbor, and I had a meeting with him in connection with somebody from the UAW, because he also wants to recruit some children of working class people to have the proper mix. By this time, the new Chinese were aboard, and they were, he said, they're doing extraordinarily well.
Huh.
And he said, but particularly in the mathematical sciences, they're extremely good. And in this connection, when Sidney Rittenberg was here, I asked him how his son was doing, who was in the ninth grade. And he says he's bored. I said, what do you mean he's bored? He said, well, for example, the mathematics he's taking now, he took in the fifth grade in China. And he certainly must have been in a special school, don't you think?
Oh, yes. And what kind of school is he in here?
It's a high school in Long Island.
Oh.
And he said, however, there is one advantage that he sees. Here, he gets the chance to ask questions, thoroughly understand the theory, whereas in China it was strictly, apparently, a rote proposition. And, that was a little story with, at least to date, a very happy ending.
Before we leave, I want to come back to the Muskie Vance affair. From your vantage point as an ambassador, we haven't really focused in a reflective way on this question. From your vantage point as ambassador, what do you think of the way the United States makes foreign policy?
There must be a special guardian angel that looks after us, that we do as well as we do, because the tremendous pressures that those individuals are under, and particularly nowadays with the advent of the jet aircraft, when they're always on the go. Always, I guess, goes back to the president, whether the president is a one who truly delegates, as Truman did to Dean Acheson, or Kennedy, who is his own Secretary of State, and the one who is over there is sort of the chief clerk keeping track of things. But it's really very, very hit and miss. You have the National Security Council, which fills a very necessary void, but existence also can create problems as between two power centers, and where the director, of course, has total access to the president, which in itself is an extraordinary influence on things when there are differences, as there were honest differences between the viewpoint of Brzezinski and the viewpoint of Vance. I have the impression that the professional foreign policy bureaucracy is not the steadying influence today that it was a generation ago. And sometimes it was not only a steadying influence in the past, it was a stultifying influence in the past. I think particularly with regard to I have the impression that was true in the events leading to the intensifying of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. But it is not a very sensible system, but our whole political system, you know, when you just describe it and think about it, you wonder how it works at all. Yet it does, I suppose, still answer the question of not having undue power centers develop, although we came awfully close to that happening in the Watergate period. If it hadn't been for some stupidities, it could have had a development that would have had untold consequences. What do you think about it?
Well, I think that the making of foreign policy is now too fragmented, excuse me, and that we have diluted the authority of the Secretary of State excessively. I do think that there has to be one person within the U.S. government who speaks authoritatively for the government abroad. And I think there has to be one office where all the strands come together. I think there has to be some discipline. And I guess I'm inclined to say that the National Security Advisor should not be that person. I think he should not be that person in part because he is not subject to the political buffeting that occurs from someone who is subject to congressional testimony and whose appointment has to be approved by the Congress, so that he doesn't have a kind of a mandate that comes from a congressional involvement. At the same time, it is clear that the Secretary of State, as that office is presently constituted, cannot perform the function. We have just witnessed the resignation of Secretary Haig, but after all, the last four secretaries of state have been knocked on the ropes by the National Security Advisor and the White House. And I think we're paying an undue price for this. And I don't think it can just no longer, can it be just attributed to the personalities. There's something structural here that is excessive. And I'm almost inclined to say we need a major overhaul of the mechanisms, so that we have a person who does embody both the role of the National Security Advisor and the Secretary, and parts of the Secretary of State, but not all of it. But I'm just beginning to try and think. I don't have any answers. All I have is a sense that this isn't working to our national interest. What we have now is not working to our national interest. The reason that I asked you questions in our last session about your relationship with all the people from other bureaucracies within the embassy, that is the non-state bureaucracies, goes to the heart of this matter. Roughly, I think it's 70% of personnel in embassies abroad and consulates abroad are non-State Department people. They report, and as you pointed out yesterday in personnel management terms, they report to the ambassador, but their loyalties and their careers are directed to their departments in Washington. And you therefore have a Secretary of Agriculture, a Secretary of Commerce, a Secretary of Treasury, a Director of the CIA, Secretary of Defense, as well as the Secretary of State, all of whom have horses in the field. None of them are subordinate to the Secretary of State. And so, therefore, all interagency disputes are going to come to the White House. And under the present system, I will always bet on the National Security Advisor beating the Secretary of State. Yet, in terms of identifying the overall national interest of the United States in a long, steady term, I think you're right that the Foreign Service offers the best bureaucracy for trying to put the various parts of the puzzle together. So I don't have an answer exactly.
Take Britain, for example. I assume that many of these policy matters are thrashed out in cabinet. Well, I think Jimmy Carter tried to use his cabinet in that fashion, but it doesn't work.
No.
Our bureaucracies are too powerful, I guess, or our whole system is so much more politicized in a disjointed fashion, whereas in the parliamentary system, you know, it focuses in the prime minister and in that party, or a combination of parties, as the case may be. You see, my relationship while I was ambassador with the various elements was not a typical one. First of all, the total aggregation was so small that one had a personal relationship that a Mike Mansfield can't possibly have in Tokyo, where there's a total complement is 700. And many of whom I'm sure he's never even met, or if he has, very casually. You know, quite a few individuals said when they came to our residence, you know, I've served here, and here, and I've never been in the ambassador's residence before, because in these bigger places, the ambassador is someone that they just don't know. The other thing is that politically, I knew well their bosses, whether you know Bob Bergland, Admiral Turner, even Admiral Turner, I knew to some extent before I went to China. So that made a difference.
That's an important point. You know, that's something I have not seen elaborated before. The advantage of a political appointment as an ambassador, what you're saying, it's very important that it's not only lines to the president, but if it's a person of substantial stature, he will be able to represent his embassy's interests to the various departmental secretaries that compose an administration. That's an important
Davis, for example, I related yesterday how the question of whether or not he should be maintained
right.
in China came to me, not for a decision, but for advice. Based on my advice, a decision was made to keep him. Well, I didn't tell Bill what had happened, but he learned about it subsequently, and he went out of his way to let me know that he was thankful for that, so that there was a personal
mm-hmm.
attachment there
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that continued. And when Jack Downing came out, I'm introduced to him, and I'm introduced to him by Admiral Turner and Frank Carlucci, of course, I had known because I made many trips to Portugal when he was our ambassador there to work with the socialists and the trade unionists there, so that was a different aspect. And there's so much in American politics that depends upon personal relationships rather than organizational relationships.
That's certainly the impression I got in Washington. We keep saying that about the Chinese, neglectful of the fact that it may pertain to us as well.
You know, when I was extremely sorry to see Vance go, but I was quite happy when Ed Muskie was
sure.
was appointed, because Ed Muskie is certainly one of my best friends in the United States Senate. And then when I when I get to Washington, and all the people are watching this, Leon Billings, who obviously has the Secretary's full support and confidence, and they see how close I am to him, that made certain subtle changes that you can't account for in any organizational manual.
So what you are saying is that at least from the vantage point of of your experience, if the ambassador has sufficient political standing in the various foreign policy centers, plural, centers of power in Washington, the ambassador can elicit a coherent foreign policy toward his country through the use of his contacts with these various centers of power, and he can try to establish a coherent policy toward his country through his frequent trips, making sure also that those people come out and visit him in his foreign post.
Yes, I think that's very well put. Dick Holbrook said it in a different way, and Holbrook, as we've observed, worked very hard at the congressional relationship.
That's right.
But he said to me on more than one occasion, you know, you and Mike Mansfield have a much easier time on Capitol Hill. They listen to you more seriously because you're a politician like they are. We're outsiders. And there's a different rapport. Well, this guy has been through the mill like I have, and he understands my problems as well as his own problems. And,
that's an excellent
that
point.
Sort of thing. See, for example, I think I may have mentioned before normalization, when I said I want to go up on Capitol Hill to discuss with Chairman Zablocki my point of view as to how the Taiwan thing can be handled. I was practically told, you're wasting your time. I wasn't wasting my time. He was very interested in getting getting my point of view, and I left the session with him thinking he could be open-minded and a step that would not endanger the well-being of the people on Taiwan would be acceptable to him, which is why it was so sad that congressional leadership was not involved in the final stage.
You know, this of all of the sessions that we've had, and we've had many are very interesting, I think this is one of the most significant exchanges that we have had, and it will have a major impact on my thinking, and let me tell you why. In the in my concerns with the way American foreign policy has been made, and that I was just trying to develop for you, the solution that I was inclined to was probably academic and reflective of my NSC experience, to try and make it coherent, intellectual, hierarchical. And what you're saying is that one has to take into account the realities of the American political system, namely that ours is a slightly brawling, diffuse, highly political system, and that what you have to do is think of a political solution to a political problem, and that one part of that puzzle has to be to have people of sufficient clout representing the United States abroad in our key positions. And you might want to argue, therefore, that far from appointing too many political people as ambassadors, we've been appointing too few, and that we ought to be thinking of very effective political representatives of the United States whose rank is quite high. But of course, the danger, let me just point out that I can see that I think that's what you're pointing toward. The danger is that you end up not with a Leonard Woodcock in Peking, but a Gene Kilpatrick or an Andy Young type, and so who then seek to make use of their base or to make ideological points. The brilliance that of your and Mike Mansfield's appointments maybe is that you were really senior people and beyond the fray.
That was a big piece of it, no question. Mm-hmm. About that. That was a big piece of it, no question about that. So that nobody was examining our positions or our actions as against ambition in either Mike's case or mine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course,
once we're going to come to that. That's a good point. I'm glad we got this on the record, and we'll come to the one point where it was thought that you behaved politically.
Right. Well, I did.
Yes. I didn't think so, being a non-political guy. But let's do that later. But go ahead. I interrupted.
And I went to see Secretary Klitznik, who was then the newly appointed Secretary of Commerce. My purpose in going to see Phil Klitznik, whom I'd known not well, but I had known before, was to talk to him about that the Chinese exhibition could not be a failure. It was too bad it had gone as far as it had in the fashion it had, but it had gone so far now that we had to take what steps we could to make sure that it was a success. And he agreed with me completely. Just turned to his staff and said, "Well, if it can't, the financing, which was the critical item at this point, can't all be done privately. We will, if necessary, step in, but we don't want to step in. That'll be the last resort. But don't worry, we will not let it founder." And he then took a personal interest in it from that point on.
Had you known Phil, by the way, before he had become Secretary of Commerce?
Yes, but not well.
He had been quite active in Jewish causes, I guess.
Yes, very much so. And then on the 23rd of May was my last personal visit with President Carter. I went in to see him, and no, it wasn't the last. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And that was the occasion when he said, I'd like you to stay on in China, Leonard. How long are you willing to stay? And I said, well, for the rest of this year, Mr. President. And he gave me his big smile and said, oh, you don't think I'm going to be reelected? Which I thought, well, I could have had a better formulation than that. But as you know, since I saw you a couple of months after that, we had our luncheon with President Shapiro. I was thinking, in any event, of leaving sometime, probably in early 81. At this point, I know that the election is going to be tough. I don't have the sense of doom that I got not too long after that.
What did you talk about to the president?
Mostly politics. And we talked about, by this time he was quite confident that he was going to come out with a majority of the delegates.
He had already that was accurate, too, in perception. He had already bested Kennedy.
Right,
he,
yes.
Although not as well as he had hoped. It was clear by then that it would go to the wire, but that Kennedy had won his reprieve at the New York primary, I guess. Or no, the New York primary was
still
June,
ahead of us.
Still ahead of us.
But
he was even more confident than he deserved. He had not yet faced that debacle in the UN, which resuscitated Kennedy's hopes,
right,
through the Jewish vote.
But in May, Kennedy was on the downswing.
That's right. That's right.
It was the screw up in the UN that changed the New York vote
and really hurt his election chances.
Right.
I think that if he had driven Kennedy out at the New York primary, he then would not have had a contested convention, and he may have gone on to win.
Yeah. But then we talked about the key to the election, the November election, is a harmonious convention. And there have to be approaches made to Kennedy and his people. We've got to put this thing together, with which I was in complete agreement. And that Doug Fraser, my successor as president of the UAW, could be a key to this because he had declared for Kennedy, but he was not one of those who had urged Kennedy to be a candidate. But after Kennedy was a candidate, had declared for him and stuck with him. So he was the best positioned to be an effective communicant to Kennedy, and I said I had not discussed this with Doug, but knowing him, I was quite positive that he too would be for pulling things together.
This raises a question that I have not asked before. I have seen public statements that your relations with Doug Fraser are cool, and that in fact you were rivals within the UAW. Could you touch on that? But, and I raise it because it's interesting that Carter would use you to... everything that you have said, by the way, through our interviews has given me the impression that public description is inaccurate.
Well...
But here it becomes pertinent.
What happened in that regard is there had been a factional history to the UAW. And when Reuther was first elected as president in 1946, Doug Fraser was a part of the opposition group. Very close to a man called Dick Leonard, who had been with us earlier but had broken prior to the 46 election and was then elected as a vice president in the opposition. And at that point, Ruther had only a minority of the executive board. We took over the whole thing in the election of November 1947 when I went on the board, and that was the end of the factional war. As a matter of fact, Doug had immediately after the 46 election in which Ruther was elected, there was a big campaign here in the state of Michigan for the Michigan CIO presidency. Gus Scholl, a well-known name in Michigan politics, was president of the Michigan CIO. He was not an auto worker, but he was a strong Ruther supporter. He was challenged, and it was a continuance of the Ruther opposition fight. His challenger was Doug Fraser. Fraser failed in that challenge. Then there was a long strike in Chrysler in 1950. By this time, Doug has been appointed to the staff of the man who was the Chrysler director. And during the long strike, in which Walter, of course, was involved, he noticed the obvious talents that Doug Fraser had. So not too long after that, he was appointed to Walter's personal staff. Then the question came up in the early 60s. One of the board members in Michigan on the west side, the area in which Doug has his membership, died, and there was a vacancy. The man who wanted to succeed this person was the president of Walter's own local, and name is Harry Southwell. Always been a loyal Ruther supporter. Doug also wanted to run. And the question was twofold. Since he was in the president's office, he shouldn't run. And secondly, he had been part of the opposition and certainly shouldn't get support for that reason. Had Walter said, no, you should not run, Doug would not have been elected to the board and none of the rest would have happened. But I argued strongly that he had a right to run. The people should make the decision, and he ran. Gus Scholl and Harry Southwell were very unhappy with me because they knew that I had been somewhat influential in that, and he was elected. When Walter unexpectedly, let me put it differently, I had made up my mind before Walter's unexpected death that at the point he got out, since I could have been elected president only for one term of then 2 years, there were many things I wanted to do in the union which wouldn't have been possible in 2 years, that I would get out at the same time and go on and do something else. But then he was unexpectedly killed, and under the Constitution, the executive board chooses the successor until the next election. After the funeral, our executive board had a meeting in which we agreed to a procedure. Emil Mazey, who was secretary treasurer and now acting president, himself not a candidate for president because of his personal health, it was agreed that he will meet in turn with every member of the board to inquire each individual, are you a candidate? If you are not a candidate, who do you support? bring that information, supposedly on a confidential basis, which is, of course, nonsense, to a meeting of the board, which was established from a week from that day. And he will start the process, this is a Friday afternoon, he will start the process on Monday, completed on Thursday, the board will reassemble on the following Friday. As I'm leaving, Doug says, I'd like to talk to you. I said, if it's about politics, I'm in no mood to talk politics. And he says, yes, it's about politics. It'll only take a few minutes. And I said, can't we do it tomorrow morning? He said, no, because I have to go to Philadelphia, because there was the funeral of the architect for Black Lake who had been killed in the same air crash. And he said, it'll only take a few minutes. So we go down to my office. And he says, people are asking me to run for president. He said, I wouldn't run against you, Leonard. You know what I think of you. And so he said, I will not be a candidate. Then he talked, he said, you know, the person who should succeed you, me, as General Motors director, is Irving Bluestone. And I said, I don't disagree with that. I said, the only problem is that Irving Bluestone is not on the executive board. And you can't have a big section of the union headed by a person who is not elected. It would be bad for morale. I said, the only way it could be done is if the board would agree that if I'm elected president, not to fill my vice presidency until the next convention. In effect, holding that place for Bluestone. And he then said, you know, this past week, you've been staying away from the guys, which I had because I was truly in a period of mourning. I was shocked by what had happened. And he said, I wish you'd come down to the hotel, the Pontchartrain Hotel, and have a drink with them. And, well, I'd been hearing that it had been that was a political nest. And that didn't surprise me, of course, but I did go down. Doug said, I need to talk to you. And he took me into a bedroom in the suite. He said, I got tremendous pressure on me to run. But he said, I'm not going to.
Again, second time.
Second time. He said, you know, it is kind of ironic. I was Walter's choice. That may be so. I doubt it, because Walter always played things close to his vest. And he said, but he says, that's all gone now. So the process started on Monday. I was the first one went in to see Maisie, and said, are you a candidate? I said, yes, I am. And he said, well, I'm for you. And he said, what about Fraser? Oh, I said, he's not going to be a candidate. We had a meeting Friday at his suggestion, in which he assured me he wouldn't be a candidate. Oh, he said, well, this will be easy then. Then he saw Greathouse second. Greathouse was for me. Then he saw Fraser, and he calls me on the telephone. He said, I thought you told me Fraser wasn't going to be a candidate. I said, yes, that's what he told me himself. He said, well, he is a candidate. He just left here, and he's a candidate. I said, obviously changed his mind. Now, at that point, we had several national officers.